Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I am delighted to have Pam Ingalls in the studio with me today. Pam is so well known on the island. She's a flourishing artist who has displayed all over the place with portraits that move the heart with their beauty and their humanity. And I want to share just a little bit of background, Pam's wonderful background, and then we'll jump into an interview about how she has lived and sustained a creative life for so many years. Because as I understand it, Pam, your background in art started a long time ago because your parents were artistic. Your father was the head of the art department at Gonzaga University.
Yeah, he started it.
He started it. And then your mom, was she a graphic designer?
A graphic artist. She had a map company.
A map company.
That she drew the little pictures on the map.
How fabulous.
For 50 years, more than 50 years.
And you even got your start working in the map company, if I understand right.
Yeah.
And then as part of your development, you studied at the Accademia, I'm getting my Italian, Accademia di Belle Arti in Florence. The Fine Art Academy? Is that how it would translate? Yeah. And you earned an art degree from the art department that your father began at Gonzaga.
Yeah.
And then you launched a career that has spanned many, many years where you have done a variety of things. You've been a social activist.
Mm.
You worked in your parents' business.
Mm.
You've done this and that. And you were able to commit to working full-time as an artist. So when did that start? When was the opening that allowed you to say, okay, I don't have to work at the this and the that and at the tile shop or the many different little things you did? I'm going to make it as an artist. When did that happen?
So let's see, 1992, I decided, okay, I went through therapy and I decided there was a point where I thought, am I doing my dream or am I doing my parents' dream? Because they certainly wanted me to do this. And finally, I just said, I don't know how you get the parents you get, but somehow I got these parents. They introduced me to this thing that I love. So I'm going to learn to paint better, you know. So I'd already had a few shows.
Was that your parents' dream that you be a fine artist?
I think so. Or at least they wanted to themselves. That was more like it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And they didn't do it.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So I think I was kind of, for a while, I was worried that I was fulfilling their dream. Not necessarily for me, but, you know. So then I finally let go of that and decided I'm going to do it. And I said, if I don't start studying now, when's it going to happen?
But that was considerably after you had done your art degree and studied in Florence.
I had already majored in art. I had already had several shows. I was painting kind of without I was very, very connected to photographs. I didn't know enough. I knew I didn't know enough. So they always say when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. I looked around and went to different art groups and found somebody that I really liked the way she painted. And I asked her if she would teach me, and she said, no, but I know who can. And so I went to see Ron Lucas, who was a Russian Impressionist painter. He studied with Sergei Bongard, and it goes way back. I had no idea who these people were.
And what if you were to describe Russian Impressionism, which I didn't know at all, what would stand out about that that someone might recognize?
I don't think most Americans have ever heard of it. But the way I like to explain it is, you know how Monet painted. he wasn't about drawing necessarily. Of course, he was good at drawing. But when you think of the haystacks or even the cathedrals, it's more about the color and in the light, of course. And in Russian painting, it's also about the drawing. So you have to draw well, and you kind of want to tell a little bit of a story somehow with your painting. So the Russians kept it alive, kept kind of traditional painting alive, while the West went kind of more modern. Mm-hmm. And they taught it from teacher to student, teacher to student. And then the Soviet Union happened, and they wanted propaganda paintings. So they wanted paintings that could relate to the common people. So they kept that alive, and they kind of poo-pooed Picasso or anything modern. So
Russian Impressionism continued into the Soviet realm?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it almost started then.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was going. Impressionism started. They had a prize for the best painter in Russia that year. And if they won, that person won, they would go to Europe and for 6 months on a kind of sabbatical paid by the Russian government. And a few of them came back after with the ideas of the Impressionists from France mostly, but also from Italy and different places in Europe. So they came back and introduced that to the ateliers there in Russia, and Russian Impressionism was born.
How interesting that they took the love of light and love of color from the French, but then infused it with their own realism or attention to detail or whatever it was that the French had softened and in some cases lost and gone on to do cubism and modernism and other things like that. What was it that moved your heart? When you saw?
At first, I didn't like it. At first, I had to believe, because this older woman, who's about my age now, I thought of her as very old. I loved the way she painted. So I thought, I trusted that this teacher could teach me. And it was really hard 3 years. I mean, almost 3 years, where I had to give up what I knew and start again. You know, I had to, of course, I had a good background already, but I had to let go of a lot of things that I learned in college or had tried to figure out and let him teach me. And it was difficult, but I was like, you know, somebody who had their hair on fire and looking for a bucket. I mean, I followed that guy everywhere. If he did a workshop in California, I would go to California. I went to his studio 4 times a week at for all the classes he taught. I went afterwards. I don't drink, but I would go to the bar afterwards and ask him questions. And I was kind of a fanatic.
But this is a good thing to highlight. And I want to make this sort of applicable to others, because people can ask, how did you get to be? And you obviously had talent and you had training, but there was a commitment, a fire that was burning in you that you would do anything. And you loved this and you committed to it for 3 years is a huge amount of time. That's like graduate school plus.
It was.
How did you support yourself?
So I was working for Irene Otis, mm-hmm. doing tiles. First I quit, and then I went back, and she let me do it at home. Then she fired me. and then I did teach children for a little while, and I just tried to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. And then, about 97, so that was 92, so it took about 5 years.
And was your goal at that point to go full-time as an artist?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. So you gave your, you put everything into that and hopefully loved it as you were doing it?
Yes, yeah, some of it.
Some of it.
A lot of answer. It was tedious, but also really difficult. And I was, you know, you expect so much of yourself. And so I had to really push myself.
Did you ever have the worries, you know, the kind of thing that some parents say to their kids about don't expect to really make a living at this, or, you know, you'll be sweeping floors or whatever if you try and make a living as a fine artist. Did that question ever occur to you, or did you just know that if you put yourself into it, there'd be a way?
I didn't really, honestly, Sally, I didn't think about the money. I really did not think, and I still don't. Uh-huh. If I think about the money, then the painting won't be good.
Yeah,
I think about what doing the best I can at what I'm trying to do.
That is so beautiful, and it also feels like this precarious spot. Because
mm-hmm.
I know just in beginning to paint, you know, that question of will it sell? It's kind of like a worm
yep.
that gets into your brain, and the joy leaches out. And so, but you know, there's a reality too, because you're a professional and you need to have things sell. But how to maintain that balance so you don't lose the spark?
Yeah.
By worrying about what others are going to think or will sell, or all those other thousand questions that could go along with it.
That's the hardest part. You know, it's one of the hard parts. I think, like, for instance, commissions are difficult because you're trying to please somebody else. I don't do that many a year, but when I do a commission, I try to trick myself by saying, I don't take any money up front. If you like it, great. If you don't like it, I got the practice.
Excellent.
And that way, I'm not thinking, will they like this stroke? What if I don't make their eyes big enough? You know, I'm trying to make a good painting. And then if they like it, and they almost always do, but once in a while, somebody doesn't. And then I just say, well, okay, sorry, I couldn't help.
Yeah, because you're not inviting them into the studio to tell you that they prefer to have gray where you have green or whatever.
Yeah,
you
right.
know, they don't get to. You're the painter.
Right. And usually they know my style. I mean, someone who commissions somebody, they know what their artwork is like.
For sure. Yeah. The art that I've seen you do and love are portraits.
Thank
did you.
You
start out doing portraits? Or
I did, actually. And then I got known in galleries in different places in the country for doing interior scenes. And I like doing interior scenes, the light coming in, or everyday objects.
Mm-hmm.
And then... this is telling my age, but when I was 50, I decided to make 50 portraits of Vashon people. And I was so shy about it, I didn't even tell people. I took a little video camera with me, and I'd be at a restaurant and carefully take a picture. I mean, you're not supposed to do that, but it was Vashon. And then I had a show at the hardware store in May. And
which I should say to people, because there'll be
yes.
others listening.
Yes.
Hardware store is a favorite restaurant in the
yeah.
middle of, and where Pam has had a number of shows.
Yeah,
now, but yeah.
yeah. So I had a show, and it was successful in so many ways. For one thing, I told people finally that I painted them, because I didn't know which ones were going to turn out. So there were 50 paintings up, and.
Did you ask their permission to show?
I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't. I do now, but I didn't. I didn't ask anybody. And I just was so shy. I mean, it was an experiment, you know. And what I really was trying to do was give a gift back to Vashon, because by that time, Vashon had already supported me so much. And I just thought, well, what can I do? And I thought, well, you know, I like doing portraits. I don't do that many a year, so maybe I'll just do that. So I called people, or maybe I went to them and said, come at this time. It was right before the opening, and that I painted you. And right before the opening, so the paintings were already there, so a couple people had already gone through. And there's this one fellow, shoot, I can't remember his name right now, but he was working at the actual hardware store, and I painted him. I was trying to paint everyday people that people would recognize, you know, like the lady who had the dry cleaner, or Trish who is at Thriftway, the grocery store, that kind of thing. And this fellow, he called me on the phone. He goes, hello? And this is, I can't think of his name. And he goes, well, guess I have to buy my painting. And I was so shocked. It was just a little painting, like 3x5. And I was like, of all the people I painted, I'd never imagined. First of all, I didn't think about selling them. But I already had my prices for the galleries, and you can't change them once they're in your in gallery. So the prices were there, and he bought his little painting. He was the first one, and then everybody came right before the opening, and we took a picture, and it was such a festive atmosphere with all these people walking around the opening and being on the walls and seeing each other. It was just a wonderful experience.
I bet the energy would have been incredible, because there's something that you do that really honors people. Oh. That's the thing. When I go to one of your exhibits, it feels like whether they are in a tenement, whether mm-hmm. they're a street person, mm-hmm. whether they're a school teacher on Vashon or a member of the LGBTQ community, because that was one of your recent exhibits, you see the spark in them. There's something where you go, you get something about their humanity. And I appreciate that so much. And it made me think of kind of several questions mm-hmm. that come out of that. You talked about, or I've heard you talk about your social activism. Yeah. And spending, was it 2 years on the road with the Catholic community?
Well, it was an ecumenical group, mostly Christian group in the early 80s. And we were talking about the arms race.
Right.
Which is still a problem.
Yeah, but you spent 2 years in pilgrimage.
Yeah, we walked across the U.S. and through Europe. And the fellow who thought it up was a Jesuit priest.
I see.
So he said, let's walk to Bethlehem where the Prince of Peace was born. So we walked there and talked to people of all faiths and asked the question, how do you justify nuclear weapons? How, you know, have you thought about it? And not with any answers. We really didn't have an answer, but we just were saying, let's talk about this. Let's do something about it, because we have way too many and it's so dangerous.
That was an inspired mission. And it also seems like fantastic preparation for getting up close and personal with people from all walks of life.
Exactly. Yeah. It was, and the walking was, once you got in shape after a couple weeks, it was easy. The walking part was the easy part. The community was the best and the hardest. There were 20 of us. So they're my closest friends still. And, anyway, we said we went to peace instead of went to war. We were peace veterans.
That was quite a commitment. And does that still live in you, that kind of social activist in perhaps a different form?
Absolutely. So, especially with the portraits, because I decided after that first show that I would paint portraits in small communities in other places. I got the idea because while I had that first show, there was a group of women, Tuvan throat singers that came to Vashon Island from a very small village in Mongolia. And I thought, wow, that little village came to our little village. And, you know, it made kind of a person-to-person connection. So I decided I'm going to go to small communities in different places and bring back the portraits, do the portraits and have them here and somehow connect our community to their community. So I went to Jamaica. I mean, I had some connection there. Mm-hmm. Tressa Aspiri was living there, and so she let me come and paint the people in her village. I went up to Nome, Alaska to paint Native Americans, because a girl I went to college with was the chief of her tribe there. I went to Guatemala, to a little village in India, in Kenya, and lots of different places.
This is Sally Fox, and I'm talking today with Pam Engels on Embracing the Muse on Voice of Vashon. That's so incredible. But you've changed your process in how you actually ask people now.
Now,
don't you?
Absolutely. Now they sign something saying that, and they get an idea what they get. They always get, they're not expected to, of course, buy their painting, but they always get a print of it. And if their painting does sell, then I give 10% back to the person and 10% back to the community. And sometimes, like in Jamaica, that 10% paid for a kid's school for a whole year, you know, because of the dynamics. Although in Alaska, didn't mean anything.
Yeah, prices are high.
Prices are way higher. But anyway.
Yeah, but I thought that was an inspired formula because I think you started out giving to the community and then the people said, but what about us? Which is a fair question.
Yeah.
And of course,
yes.
When you're an artist, you can't be fluctuating your prices, you know. So to be able to say, here, you get the fruits of my work in a photograph is
a print of
a print. Yeah. Is totally inspired. And do you paint from photographs or are you on the spot with them?
No. Well, usually when I go someplace different than Vashon, I bring a little paint box and paint a little tiny painting, 5x7 painting from life and give that to them.
Yes. Oh, you do?
I do.
So they get something. They get live from the artist.
Yeah.
I love
that. And then also I take video of them.
So, oh, really?
And then I can stop the frame exactly where I want. I got that idea because my husband is a videographer, or he did a lot of that. And so I'm like, oh, that just changed everything. Because, if I was going to paint a waitress and she's moving, I can stop the frame exactly where I want it.
Fantastic.
So that changed everything.
Well, and it also, I want to know a little bit more about how you paint because our mutual friend, Bruce Morser, I'm not really a drawer, but he inspired me to start learning to draw. And the part of the guidance that he always says is don't draw the thing.
Yeah.
Don't draw the thing because you'll go into your head, draw the line, the light, the shape, or potentially the color, although we were working in black and white. I have a sense that you probably do that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's that thing where I was saying my teacher had to kind of break me of habits because I knew how to draw basically.
So if you were to draw me,
yes.
I'm in the studio and this would be a terrible place to draw anybody because of the light and all
actually,
that.
Actually, the light isn't bad. It's on one side of you. Yeah. It's easy.
What would you be thinking of?
I'd be thinking, where is the light? What color is the light? Is it a warm light or cool light? What are the colors on the darker side of your face? It's very cool. I see a lot of green. And then I would look for the shapes. The way I teach and the way I learned is separate the light from the dark. And that's what gets the form. And then you can slowly get more detailed, more specific, smaller shapes.
So first it's light and seeing, already what you said indicates a whole understanding of light and color that most of us don't have, to be able to distinguish, well, this is a greeny light, not a yellowy light, or this is a, most of us just think light, shadow, exactly. That's it. But you see a lot.
Yeah. And I think once you start painting, at least whatever you decide to pay attention to in whatever you're studying, you really start seeing the world a completely different way. So I do teach workshops a couple times a year because I feel like I have to pass it on. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times people after the second day or something, they go, wow, I saw so much difference the street was purple. I always thought it was gray. Or, you see so much color in the sky or in the clouds instead of just black and white, or just you say, well, it's gray.
Mm-hmm. Those are all artistly things to think about. When I've seen, and I remember watching the exhibit of your people from New York.
Okay,
in the
good.
Tenement. And... I fell in love with them.
Oh,
which meant that you must have fallen in love.
I did.
How do you do that? And then how do you, because there's something that's beyond light and color and shape and all the other artful elements. There's something else that you're pulling forward. How do you do that? And what do you?
I don't know, Sally. Some of that I don't know. I mean, I see students have a certain sense or even just a certain brushstroke. And at the beginning, it's a little bit naive. And by the time they are a good painter, they have that same thing. That's who they are. And you like people try to make a style, but you can't make a style. You are the style. So,
but how do you get with that? How do you get the love?
You just keep doing it, and you feel the love, and it just happens. I can't tell you how that happens. It just is. I remember way before I studied with Ron Lucas, I was painting street people in Seattle, big portraits of street people. And my dad said something about that. He said there's a sense of, what did he say? Something like, not dismay, but some kind of emotion in the painting. And I said, he goes, did you mean that? And I said, well, I don't know. He goes, well, just hang on to it. Don't worry about it. You know, because he could feel that even though I was really connected to the photograph, I could not let go. I didn't know anything. I was just copying the photo. But I just think that's just in me. I don't know how to teach that part.
What I've found, because I coach people and I coach them on telling their stories, that I know I'm winning in a certain sense when I fall in love.
Yes.
When I love their story and I love them. And even if I didn't know them, I'll find something that just moves me. And then I know, okay, we've hit the note because I can feel them in a different way. And I've also done this thing, you know, I tell you I'm not a drawer, but I have spent time drawing people. Mm. And recently a friend died, and I spent time drawing her face. I felt like it was a sacred act.
Absolutely.
Because I loved her, and just trying to capture her was like sitting with her and drawing her in more deeply. So I can imagine when you're working on a portrait over time, you're also drawing in someone and allowing them to move you.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not just portraits. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can paint a cup. I fall in love with whatever I paint. You know, I can paint a butter dish with the butter on it. And the more you look, the more you see, the more interesting it is. And I just kind of go, wow, you know, that's... Mm-hmm. It's beautiful how that happens, and you start noticing it everywhere, you know, on your kitchen, your sink faucet or something, you know.
You do, and that's why I'm so excited about, you know, inviting people to engage creatively, because mm-hmm. it's not just about producing stuff. It's a way of discovering wonder in the world.
There you go. That's beautiful.
And we need that. You know, life's a little dark out there.
Yeah.
So how wonderful to see a cup and find a world in it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. How do you sustain this? Because it feels like, you know, I could really say it's painting as a sacred act when you're capturing people the way that you do. But how do you sustain that over the long haul? Because you've been at it now 40 years. And that is, are you like me? I'm 72. I'm honest about this.
Yeah,
are you getting the same range?
I'm getting closer.
Yeah.
70, I'm getting closer.
Yeah, yeah.
I just had a birthday, so
congrats.
I'm like, uh-oh.
No, we have to celebrate, ma'am.
Okay,
we have to celebrate.
That.
Like, I'm 72 and I'm proud.
Yeah,
you know?
Good.
But sustaining something over time, especially when you're also making your living at it, is no small thing. So how do you keep finding the joy and the spark and the motivation to keep going?
It's a good question. So I always feel like I have two parts to me. The part that does the art and actually falls in love and all that kind of stuff. And the part that's kind of the business person. And if I let the business person take over too much, then the art falls apart. But they're a team, you know, they're kind of a team. And I don't know if this is answering your question.
No, it does. It's really key. Mm-hmm.
But it's, I just always have to remember that kind of gentle part of me is really in charge. And to feed it by looking at other people's art that I really like, or experimenting a little bit, or thinking up kind of new ideas of who I want to paint or what I want to paint, that kind of thing. Try to get inspired. I think social media has helped a lot, because I have some interesting favorite artists that I will go back to, you know, oh, how did they do that? How did they, you know, make that edge. Or I just feel like it's always about learning. So if I'm going to keep going, I'm just always trying to learn to get better at it. And
I think that's a total key. I mean, having curiosity and the desire to learn, because again, when I wrote my book, Meeting the Muse After Midlife, I wanted to just say to people, we'll lose a lot physically, but we never have to lose our desire to learn and our curiosity. So let's invest in that. Let's pour ourselves into that, because that's what can sustain us over the long haul. You know? Your parents were both artists, but they also put a lot into their business. Do you feel like they had to, the business kind of took over for them? Or?
Yes, I think so. My mom had a lot of, I mean, she was brilliant. She had a couple of patents on color reproduction, and she started her map company when she was like 26, I think, 25 or 26. And just brave and going out there and selling ads and doing all that kind of stuff. And I always thought that before that and after that, she also painted portraits, you know, for kind of fun. And she was a good painter, and she didn't get to do that enough. She didn't get to study her color enough because the business took part of her life. But because of that business, I learned, I mean, actually, I came from kind of a business family. So, I mean, her mom and her mother, too, and all the cousins, almost every single one has their own business of some kind. Mm-hmm. So I learned a lot from them of how to make things work.
We're listening to Pam Engels on Embracing the Muse over Voice of Vashon.
And my dad, I don't know. My dad, he was the first art major from a Jesuit university ever, because they didn't used to have art departments. And he was kind of a star at Seattle U. And he did have one big show when I was probably 12 or something. And it was 50 drawings. And I think I have that in the back of my mind, that a show has to have 50 in it, you know? So I almost always do at least 50 paintings for a show. Anyway, so he kind of showed me how to do that too, how to have an opening. We were the ones who gave punch out, my sister and I, and, you know, and that he had to frame everything. So I kind of got an education from them.
That's extraordinarily useful. Yeah. I think a lot of fine art grads come out with inspiration and technique, but they don't quite get, you know, what it takes to have a show, what it takes to go through all the framing and the curation and the publicity and the punch, and, you know,
exactly, the hors d'oeuvres and stuff. Yeah,
yeah, and the smiles and the cultivating relationships and the whole works.
Even my teacher, the Russian impressionist guy, Ron Lucas, he did not teach us at all what to do with the paintings. So he didn't do a great job at that himself. He was very, very shy. He ended up going to DreamWorks when it started and was a background painter. Fabulous. He's really a fantastic painter. Mm. And anyway, so he got a job doing his work. I don't know. I haven't asked him or talked to him in a long, long time, but if he still paints in his garage.
Oh, good. At least he's still painting.
He still paints. And the backgrounds can be paintings, too. So he said he did more paintings in a year than he ever had when he first started there.
Well, I know you still teach. I know you taught younger kids, and I know you teach adults. Yeah. And it sounds like a dream vacation, a retreat in Tuscany to be able to study oil painting. What could be more fun than working with you in Italy? I know you'll give your students a lot of your art practice. How do you convey to them that invisible essence of curiosity, learning, and allowing yourself to live a creative life? Does that make sense as a question? You know, what is it you would give to them or would say about that piece?
I think demonstrating it is the way to do it. You know, I mean, just by being excited about what I'm showing them and then being clear about how it works. You know, that it's kind of a dichotomy of two parts to it. Be excited about it. pick what inspires you, really, you really like, or you kind of are curious about. And then I let go of that afterwards and use my skill to express it. But how to make them feel, I think people come already with a little bit of curiosity. They wouldn't be in a workshop if they didn't really want to try it or try something new. And I think, I don't know that I actually say, you know, make sure you get inspired or something like that, but hopefully they're getting that idea from the way I teach.
We're listening to Pam Engels on Embracing the Muse over Voice of Vashon. Kind of last question here. When you're in the midst of a really connected painting session, do you ever feel like something else is with you in that space? Tell me about that.
It only happens a couple times a year, to tell you the truth.
Uh-huh.
Once in a while, I'm painting something, a portrait or something, and I paint beyond my own skill. And I step back and I want to look behind my shoulder. Who did that? Did I do that? You know, and I don't know how that happens. You cannot make that happen. It just happens. And I think everyone who does any kind of art has had that experience. It could be music, it could be poetry, it could be writing, whatever. I think there's a point where, something unconscious, or you could call it spiritual, something happens that you didn't control, and you let go, and you let that part of you do it.
And surprise yourself.
And you're surprised, definitely.
When even when you're not making one of these pieces that surprises you, is that often the case, though, when you're in that zone of creation, that the door is open to a kind of flow of energy that might not be part of regular life or doing your books? Or
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. Like I say, I can't control that part, so I don't know that I actually feel it at the moment. Once in a while, I suppose, but mostly I'm working. Mostly I'm in, this is how I do it. So I start all the paintings at once. I mean, one after the other, after the other, after the other, then I go back and I look at them with fresh eyes and I work on each one again, and sometimes three. Some, but once in a while, one will work just like that. And those are the best ones, the freshest, the cleanest, the strongest. And so there was something else about that I was going to say. Oh, I also I'm always doing tricks to myself to try and not get my critical brain involved too much in the painting. And so I find that a lot of people play music or something like that, but I can't really play music. I get involved in the music and the words to the songs or whatever. So a lot of times I listen to podcasts or something else that keeps my, like a book on tape or something, that keeps my critical mind busy, and then my unconscious can just do the work.
I totally get that. I think it's a brilliant idea. I've heard people who say, you know, just give your critical mind a task, you know, let it enjoyable listening to something that's kind of going on in the background so that you can do the other work.
Right.
Yeah. But it also sounds like you do the work. I do. I don't know the right quote about folks who talk about inspiration and perspiration, but I do know that for a writer, it's butt time, and that in the chair for a painter, it's time.
Yeah.
It's working it.
It's a lot of work.
It is. How long does it take to do is there an average, like if you had 50 paintings that you needed to produce, how long would each one likely take?
People ask that question often, and I like to say what my dad used to say. He would say, well, it took about 50 years and, or well, 30 years or whatever, 30 years and 5 hours. Uh-huh. Or 30 years and, you know, a few hours.
Yeah. It's like the Japanese brush painters who have the same answer. They have spent their life being able to do something in 10 seconds.
Exactly.
But it took a life to get to those 10 seconds.
Right.
So I don't.
Because often people might say, you mean you're charging that much money and it only took you 5 hours or whatever, you know? I'm like, yeah, but it took me 30 years to get to this point, you know? And that's what you're.
For me, it's more looking at the freshness and the amount of work you generate. Because the LGBTQ exhibit, you had a lot of work there.
Yeah. And I go for 50 every
time. You go for 50 every time, and they were 50 good paintings, you know. So you go, whoa, that's a lot of production. And they're all good, you know, and they all capture something. So I know you're busy, and so I want to honor your time, but I loved going behind the scenes with you, that creative mind. And I hope people will be encouraged by this idea that, you know, with curiosity, with learning, with the painting equivalent to butt time.
at the easel.
With the merger of business and creativity, because they can both go together, and also being open to the mystery of what can come in, you know, and so much more that you've given us today. But thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally. This is really fun. Thanks for being interested and inviting me.
If you want to learn more about my guest, and I hope you do, check out Pam's work at pamingalls.com. That's pamingalls.com. There you can also learn about the fabulous art retreat that she is running in Tuscany in September. As of this recording in June, there was one place left, and you'll be so lucky if you get it. You can also learn more about Pam on the show notes for this episode of Embracing the Muse on Voice of Vashon. Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon 101.9 FM for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.